from WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina. This is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's common knowledge that black bears, coyotes, feral swine, and snakes of the venomous and non-venomous varieties roam the mountainous and more rural parts of North Carolina. But wildlife experts tell us that all of these species also live in the southeastern corner of the state. In fact, the black bear population is thriving in the Cape Fear region. Wildlife biologists report more encounters between people and black bears in coastal North Carolina as people move to the area and build houses on what was habitat. Feral swine, previously known as the protected wild boar, have been in North Carolina since the early 1500s, imported by European explorers as a reliable source of meat. But in the early 2000s, state biologists changed their opinion on these animals, determining them to be so destructive that a feral swine task force is now working to eradicate them from the wild. North Carolina has almost 40 species of snake, but only about 6 are venomous. However, even the venomous ones have an important role to play in the ecosystem. We are at the northern extent of the alligator habitat range, and it's been difficult to get a handle on how many live in the state. They're a long-lived species and take many years to reproduce. They also grow more slowly here than they do farther south, so it takes years to gather data. But are they dangerous to people? When should they be removed from neighborhoods? Here to help us explore these questions and talk about what we do know about these animals, which are literally right in our own backyard, are two biologists. Alicia Davis is alligator biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Alicia Davis, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Fallon Owen specializes in unexpected interactions between people and wild animals. She is the Extension Wildlife Biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Fallon Owens, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Glad to have both of you here. Now, let's talk safety first, because before people get interested in wildlife, they want to know what the threat is to them. And we'll talk about all the species, but first, let's go to alligators, since we're hearing now in the summer from people about seeing alligators in retention ponds, in backyard ponds. People move here from areas that don't have alligators, and then they're surprised to find that they live here. How many people have died by alligator in the Cape Fear region?
Zero. None.
Really? None?
Yeah. In fact, I only know of less than a handful of people have actually been bitten by alligators, and all of those were either people that were actively trying to catch the alligator, jumping on the alligator, or doing something they really shouldn't have been doing, like swimming intoxicated in Greenfield Lake, where it's posted very plainly that that's prohibited, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I remember that happening. That was back in the mid-aughts, I think. 2004 or 5, somebody jumped into the lake, and it's known that we've got alligators there. How large? Up to, I mean, more than 12 feet, I think I've heard.
We probably have some 12-footers in that area. The largest in the state record, is about 13 and a half.
And where was that one found?
Up in Hyde County.
Which
in a very remote area on the Albemarle Peninsula.
Someone posted on social media recently about a dead dog floating in a pond in one of the neighborhoods, one of the residential neighborhoods in Brunswick County. And people were quick to assume that the alligator that was nearby had killed the dog. I don't know that that was ever established. But we hear these horror stories, and we hear about real incidents out of Florida. What's the difference between alligator behavior here in North Carolina and alligator behavior in Florida? Are they more dangerous there, or are there just more of them?
I think there's a higher density of alligators and people in Florida, so more opportunities for negative interactions than there are here. Of course, that is changing, you know, as development continues on the coast here in North Carolina. We will continue to see more interactions between people, and not only alligators, but other wildlife as well.
Are they known to charge out of the water and go after people? the way we have seen perhaps crocodiles do.
No, they're much more shy and secretive than, say, a crocodile. You know, that what can change that behavior, of course, is if they're fed by people, which is true there, again, not only for alligators, but for other wildlife as well. But as far as, you know, you were talking about the dog that was found floating, that may very well have been an alligator. I can't say one way or the other, but I do regularly tell people alligators don't know the difference between a possum and a poodle. And so, you know, it's really important for us to be good pet parents.
And what does that mean? Certainly letting dogs off leash, that becomes a risk for the dog, or letting cats outside, of course.
Yes.
But how close can people walk their dogs on a leash around a pond with an alligator in it?
I personally wouldn't walk mine right next to the water, and certainly don't let your dog swim in waters where alligators have been seen. But the best that you can do, the number one thing that you can do is to, of course, walk your dog on a leash, because they do really view people as a threat and are intimidated by people.
We see snakes a lot in the coastal region, and many people have heard water moccasins, copperheads are dangerous to people, but they don't know how to identify them, and people will often say the only good snake is a dead snake. Phalaenoans, how should people think about snakes that they might encounter in their backyards around here, and are they dangerous?
Oh, boy. First thing I can say is we have a lot of species of snakes in North Carolina, and most of them are harmless. And I would say that as long as somebody understands that snakes only bite in self-defense to protect themselves from an animal that's much, much larger than they are, you know, they're trying to save themselves from a dire threat. And a snake that is not put in a situation where it has to defend itself is not going to bite a person. So really any snake can be rendered harmless just by giving it space, respecting that they can bite if pressed, and leave them alone. They're very happy to leave us alone.
What about letting your dog out into a backyard? We do hear about dogs getting bitten by snakes in suburban areas around here. What's mm-hmm. the best way to protect your domestic animals?
Sure, that's a great question. If you have a dog that maybe is prone to messing around with wildlife, the best recommendation I can give is to remove anything out of your yard in the immediate area that your dog runs around in that's going to attract snakes in the first place. So things like log piles or brush piles or dense ivy, those are hiding places that snakes will feel comfortable in, and they'll spend time there just to get away from threats. But those places also attract rodents, which for most of the snakes that people are worried about, those rodents are their primary food source. So where you have vegetation up against the ground or rock piles or brush piles against the ground that can attract rodents, you're going to get snakes. And removing those things is how you can actually reduce the possibility of having snakes in your yard.
And we've heard from a garden expert on this show that pampas grass is notorious for attracting rodents and snakes. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you observe?
I would say it's less about the species and more about the density of the vegetation. So ivy is number one. You wouldn't want ivy, a lot of ivy on the ground, but even tall grass of any kind, bushes that have limbs that go all the way to the ground. If you've got vegetation that's dense all the way down to the ground level, that's a great place for snakes and rodents and other wildlife to hide.
We are seeing videos now of black bears coming into people's backyards in some of these suburban areas that are newly developed. What's the best thing that people can do to stay safe? What do they need to know?
Sure. We have some of the biggest black bears around. The record black bear in the entire world was from eastern North Carolina. And the good news is that even though we've got these big black bears in this part of the state, they really are not interested in people as a food source, or they really don't want to mess with us, except that human beings can provide a lot of tasty snacks for bears in the form of bird feeders and loose trash and other things. So being aware that you can attract bears by accident to your yard by having bird feeders up, or maybe having a beehive in your yard that's not protected with, say, electric fencing. You know, those are great ways to attract bears to your yard. But in terms of what you can do if you see one, again, as with snakes, you know, leave them alone, give them space. They'd really rather be left alone by us. They do not want to be put into a situation where they have to defend themselves from us.
And quickly, feral swine, the things that we used to call wild boar, are these dangerous to humans?
Fortunately, I can say that for the most part, feral swine are not really considered to be a direct threat to people. Certainly, they are very capable of defending themselves if put into a corner. You never want to corner a feral swine, but you know, most of the experiences that people have with feral swine is seeing sort of the tail end of them, because the second they see people, they're going to run in the opposite direction. So, and that's pretty much the extent of the experience you can expect to have.
And so it seems like the theme here in terms of animal safety, if I'm hearing you correctly, is none of them want to come in contact with a human. They just want to get away. So if we give them space to do that, we probably won't get bitten or mauled or harmed or killed.
Absolutely. That's perfect.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about North Carolina wildlife today, what you need to know about alligators, snakes, bears, and other species, with two biologists from the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. We'll be back from this short break in 90 seconds. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. As explosive growth continues in the Cape Fear region and developers build houses on what used to be habitat, we're seeing more human-wild animal encounters. Today, two state biologists are with us to teach us about some of the more feared and misunderstood species. Fallon Owens is the Extension Wildlife Biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. She specializes in unexpected interactions between people and wild animals. Alicia Davis is an alligator biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission and is also spearheading new research on the state's gator population. And Alicia Davis, why has it been so difficult for officials, state officials, to get a handle on the alligator population here in North Carolina? We still don't know how many there are, right?
Right, yes. And that's really the question I hear the most is, how many alligators do we have? But as a biologist, I know that that's really only one small piece of the puzzle. So not only are we interested in how many we have, we're interested in what the status of the population is. And in order to get there, we also need to know how many of the alligators are reproductive adults versus juveniles versus subadults. What is the survival rates of these different age classes? What are the sex ratios? Do we have, you know, more males than females or vice versa, that sort of thing? And really, to get at that, we just need so much population level data that it takes a very long time to get there.
And alligator studies haven't really been funded very well in North Carolina. Why is that?
Well, because they're a reptile. So a lot of the really well-known wildlife restoration success stories in North America are often funded by the Pittman-Robertson Act of 1937. And this is a piece of legislature that basically puts a excise tax on guns, ammunition, and archery equipment, And then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service distributes those funds to the states to do their wildlife population monitoring and restoration efforts. This has really played a big role in success stories such as white-tailed deer, bear, wild turkeys, etc. However, by definition, those funds can only be used for wild birds and mammals. So we cannot use those funds for alligators. Typically what we use for reptiles, amphibians, and our aquatic invertebrates like mussels is what we call a state wildlife grant dollars. Those are also from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we need to match those 35% with 35% state funds. However, it's a much smaller pot of money. And so we've been prioritizing those funds on species that we know are in decline and that need more assistance. So think about bog turtles and gopher frogs and hellbenders. And a lot of our reptiles and amphibians are in need of conservation attention, and that's where we've been prioritizing those funds.
And we don't know for sure that alligators are, right? Do you think the population is healthy, even if you don't have numbers?
We think that the population is either stable or slightly increasing. And so that's why we've not been prioritizing those funds until kind of recently, when there's been a lot more interest here in the last few years.
And you mentioned that one of the reasons, or rather, you're more interested in how many adults that are at reproductive capability are there happen to be. Alligator gender is an interesting topic in itself. As I understand it, their gender is not determined at the moment of conception, but
That's
it's
right.
determined by the temperature during a certain period in the nesting process when they're still inside mama?
Yes, and inside the nest. So during that middle third...
So she's given birth to the eggs then?
Yes.
She's put the eggs in the nest.
That's right.
I don't
right.
know what the appropriate word would be for that.
So when she lays the eggs in the nest, it's about that middle third of the incubation period. The incubation period is about 60 to 80 days. She doesn't sit on the nest like a chicken. she's going to lay all the eggs in this big, great big nest. It kind of looks like it's big enough for Big Bird to sit on it. And she lays all the eggs in this one cavity in the middle, and then closes it all up, and it basically works like a big compost pile. And so that vegetation, as it decomposes, that heat that it generates is actually what incubates the eggs. And she'll guard the nest throughout the incubation period. She'll come and replace some vegetation, move stuff around to however she thinks it needs to be. And she'll chase off predators, things that want to come and raid the nest for eggs, like raccoons and things. And then,
so the temperature then that happens during this critical nesting period will make it more likely that those baby gators are male or female?
That's right. So in that middle third of the incubation period, the lower temperatures are females and the higher temperatures are males.
So if it is, then I would think that in a place like North Carolina, when you have a certain kind of temperature, is it likely that we have, say, more females than we do males, because this is a colder climate for alligators compared to their, you know, southern neighbors? And what are you finding in the early stages of your research?
That's a question that I've had, and you might expect to see that, but what I find is that we see just as many males as we do females, if not more. There again, that may also be due to a difference in behavior between males and females. Females tend to be even more shy and more likely to go under the water and hide when a person comes along than a male would be.
And there's also a size issue versus age issue for reproductive ability. Can you tell us when alligators are able to reproduce, male and female?
So reproductive maturity is not related to age. It's related to size. And that's, they're reproductively capable at 6 foot. However, because they're reptiles, once the temperature drops below 60, they cannot metabolize food, and so they stop eating. So here in North Carolina, you know, where we have a true winter, it's going to take a lot longer for them to reach reproductive maturity than it does, say, in Florida, for example. That is the difference between, you know, in Florida, it might be 8 or 10 years when they're reproductively mature versus 20 years for females up here. That's a really long time.
So is it likely then that most of the alligators people would see in their local retention pond or the backyard pond, those are smaller gators, you know, a 6-foot gator is looking large to some folks here. So those are what, subadults, some form of juvenile alligator not able to reproduce?
Right. Between 3 and 6 foot is a subadult size class. And in South Carolina, where they have over 35 years worth of mark recapture data from a coastal population, they've seen very few females below 7 foot actively nesting. And so we don't actually know if that's the case here or not. We haven't come across a female that small or between 6 and 7 foot that's been reproducing. And so if that's the case, it may be, you know, 25 or more years before a female is old enough and large enough to actually be able to reproduce here.
You're listening to Coastline, and it's an exploration of the wild animal population that shares the Cape Fear region with humans. My guests today are Alicia Davis. She's an alligator biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, and Fallon Owens. She's the extension wildlife biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Fallon Owens, black bears, you say, are ubiquitous on the North Carolina coast, and they're also here in the southeastern corner of the state. How are they able to survive here, and why are they so fat?
they're able to survive because, at least historically, we've got a really amazing area here in the coastal part of the state that has a lot of rural space where bears can be by themselves and do berry things without being bothered by people. And we also have a lot of agriculture in this part of the state. And that is really the biggest reason why we have such big bears in coastal North Carolina. Those agricultural crops, the corn crops and other things, you know, bears are very happy to scavenge whatever they can from the environment. They're very lazy hunters. So if their food sources don't run away from them, that's what they want to go for. So waste crops with our agricultural fields are an amazing food source for them. And they're able to put on a lot of weight just from that.
And so you said they're lazy. They are omnivores, right?
Yes.
So they'll eat meat.
Mm-hmm.
But what makes up most of their diet here at the beach?
Oh, you know, bears will eat anything that's got calories in it for the most part. But like I said, if it doesn't move or run away, that's really what they're going to be focusing in on. So naturally, they'll eat, you know, berries and nuts and grubs, so insects. And where people are, they'll also eat crops. And especially in residential areas, they're very happy to go for bird feeders. You know, one bird feeder that's full of bird seed can provide more than enough calories for a single bear, an adult large bear, for an entire day. So if a bear can get to a bird feeder, it's easy going for the rest of the day. They don't have to worry about being hungry. And that's a really big food source for bears in residential areas.
Are these protected species?
They are protected. Black bears are one of our major game species here in North Carolina, which basically means that they are one of the most protected species. But there is a hunting season and they can be hunted. It's very regulated. So we keep, as an agency, the Wildlife Resources Commission, keeps excellent data on our bear populations, whether the populations are increasing or decreasing in the different parts of the state. We know a lot about our black bears. And a lot of the reason for that is because we have hunting seasons and we can get that data from our hunters.
So what do we know about the population in terms of numbers?
We have very robust populations of bears in the coastal part of the state and in the mountain region. not so much in the Piedmont, but I would say across all three regions of North Carolina, the populations are steady to slightly increasing. And since we have such robust populations, we're actually trying to manage bears to keep their population steady. We don't really want or need more black bears because they're really doing great. So we can actually tweak the hunting seasons so that if hunters harvest more bears, we can help keep that population steady and stable, which is what we want to do.
How old do bears have to be? At what point are they able to reproduce?
Yeah, they get sort of booted out from Big Mama's territory at about 1.5 years old, after which point they will kind of wander off on their own. And that's right around where they might start seeking a mate to reproduce. So, you know, 1.5 to 2 years old is about when you might start to see bears reproducing.
And how big might they be at this point?
Oh, you had to ask me weight questions. Yeah. I'm not the bear biologist.
That's fair. You are the one who specializes in unexpected interactions between people and wild animals. Oh, so
I'll throw out over 80 pounds. Sounds good, but the bear biologist might say that's not quite correct.
Okay, and fair enough. And if we hear from that person, then we'll put a correction on the website. But going back to bear weight, just for a second, you said the biggest bear that was actually found at the North Carolina coast in Hyde County, which is in the northeastern part of the state. Do you know how much that bear weighed? And this was the biggest bear in the world.
Yeah, well, the
biggest black bear.
Biggest black bear, right? There's a lot of bear species, but and it was actually Craven County in 1997. There was a black bear harvested legally in Craven that was 880 pounds. And that is larger than the average grizzly bear. That was a really, really big black bear. And it was mostly fat. It was a living, high on the hog, I suppose you could say.
In a manner of speaking, and we'll get to the hogs in a moment. But first, do bears hibernate here?
So technically, because we have we don't have really, really harsh winters here in North Carolina. We do have true winters, but they're not really harsh. Bears don't quite go into the full-on textbook hibernation, but they do kind of take very long naps in the wintertime around here.
Now, you mentioned hogs, and there is a feral swine task force to take out these creatures that we used to call wild boar. And they were protected. Now we want to completely get rid of them, not manage the population, but eradicate them. Why? Why do we need to eradicate them?
Well, feral swine are pretty damaging. We have a lot of information from other states across the country that have been dealing with feral swine for a very long time. And there's robust information that shows that they pose a real legitimate threat to our native wildlife, to our agricultural crops in the form of crop damage. The diseases that they carry pose real serious threats to our livestock industry. And some of the diseases that they carry can transmit to humans and be dangerous to humans as well.
What are some of those diseases?
Well, so feral swine, especially for livestock, the primary ones that we are concerned with, I'm primarily speaking for the North Carolina Department of Agriculture, because they actually manage our livestock. They're concerned about brucellosis, which is contagious and really pose a threat to domestic swine. And there's kind of an oncoming disease called African swine fever that is incredibly contagious and incredibly deadly that thankfully is not here in North Carolina yet. I don't believe it's in the United States yet. But if it does get here, it's going to be really, really bad news. So we're trying to monitor any threats that might bring it into the state. And feral swine are definitely a way that disease could spread very quickly.
And spread to humans, you're saying?
So African swine fever, thankfully, doesn't affect human beings, but it is very bad news for swine. It's deadly for domestic swine and feral swine as well, and very contagious.
How long does it take? I understand that feral swine are domesticated pigs run amok. How long does it take for a little pink pig with white fuzz to turn into a spotted, tusked, feral swine?
You got to have a lot of respect for domestic pigs. They're such really amazing animals, and they can sort of go feral to the point of developing their long, bristly, wild fur and longer tusks really just in a matter of one or two generations. So that pink pig that escaped from a farm can find a way to reproduce, and its piglets or the subsequent piglets immediately after that can basically just completely turn feral.
So what is the plan to get rid of them?
We are trying to find ways to sort of tackle the problem from every angle possible, because it's a difficult problem. We have sort of pockets of feral swine across the entire state, and we are primarily trying to focus on trapping of feral swine, because they're very smart animals, and they get educated about avoiding potential risks very quickly. They're just incredibly smart. So trapping entire sounders, that's an entire family group at once, before they know how to avoid people, avoid traps, is really our best bet. Try to get them before they're smart enough to avoid us.
And then you kill them.
Yeah, it's actually illegal in North Carolina to release a feral swine alive from a trap. And it's also illegal to transport them. And there are very steep fines involved. We do not want these animals being released or relocated.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of North Carolina's wildlife with two state biologists. We'll be right back after this short break and also learn more about that alligator research that's underway. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Real estate development in the Cape Fear region, especially in Brunswick County, continued at a brisk pace through the pandemic, and as a result, wild animals and humans are coming into contact more often. Today, two state biologists are with me to help us understand more about feral swine, black bears, alligators, and snakes, just some of the species that they say are wildly misunderstood. Alicia Davis is an alligator biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, and Fallon Owens is the extension wildlife biologist with the WRC. Alicia Davis, as you've explained, there is more research going on around the alligator population in the state than there has been in years past. Can you talk about the work that you're doing tagging alligators right now? And there are two different kinds of tags, is that right? Or two different studies going on?
Mm-hmm. So in 2017, we initiated a new marketing data collection protocol in which any wild alligator that's handled in North Carolina for any reason, we tag it with a PIT tag, which is basically the same microchip that the vet puts in your cat or your dog. So we can scan it and get a barcode, whether it's 20, 30, 50 years from now, we'll be able to tell what individual that is. We also are taking measurements on those animals, whether it's the first time we caught them or when they're recaptured later on. With that information, we can learn more about those growth rates of animals in different size classes and things. And then, of course, taking GPS coordinates of places where, you know, where the capture site and the release site, if it's not the same.
And there's been some confusion, I guess, because we haven't had data about, for instance, if someone comes to remove a large alligator or an alligator that's been showing no fear of humans from a residential neighborhood and relocates that gator to, say, Holly Shelter Game Land area. does the alligator try to come back to its original pond, or does the alligator survive in the new place in, say, Holly Shelter? What are we learning about what they're doing?
Yeah, and that's a really good question that we've been very interested in as well. So there is ample literature from other states where they have documented alligators trying to return back to their home territory. So they have a really strong homing instinct, but not always. You know, we have evidence of both them staying where they're relocated and trying to return. So to try and tease out, you know, when is it successful versus not, we've started putting GPS transmitters on some of the animals that we've relocated in the last, well, since 2018. And to try and figure out, you know, is there a certain age class that it's more successful, more likely to be successful? Is there, is that different for males versus females? Is there a certain, a minimum distance that we need to relocate them for them to stay there? What we've found, we certainly have seen these animals. They may wait a year or so. Some of them try to return right away, but we certainly have seen individuals heading back to their home territory. They don't always make it. Sometimes they get poached. Sometimes they get hit by cars. And then we do also have evidence of situations where they have stayed where we put them. And even I even have documented where one female 3 years later actually nested and had a clutch of young in the place where she was relocated to. So that was really exciting.
How at risk are they for if you brought, say, a younger male alligator from a residential neighborhood and dropped him in a new place in Holly Shelter? Are there alpha males there that will go after him? Will he become prey? How does that work?
That is one concern and not something that we really have an answer to. That is a question that we have. Of course, there are other risks as well besides just potentially being in another larger alligator's territory. You know, if they, like I said, if they try to return home especially, they're more likely to be hit by a car trying to cross a road. Or unfortunately, sometimes they get poached even in very remote areas.
What is the leading cause of death for alligators in the state?
I want to say poaching. Last year, I know we documented 25 mortality events, and it was either 9 or 11 that were poached, but there were also just as many motor vehicle strikes as well.
So that's a big issue for alligators.
Yes.
In the state's alligator management plan, there's a 2004 study that's cited that describes the small wetlands that alligators create and calls them gator holes. What's the benefit of these gator holes? What are they like and what do they do?
Yeah, so they have a few different names. You might hear them called wallows or gator holes. That's usually what I call them. But they basically, you know, will dig out a big area that retains water, and so that can be really beneficial to other species during times of drought because it'll be an important area of refugia for other critters.
What does that word mean? Refugia?
Refuge. Mm-hmm. So a place where they can stay and have access to water, whereas if the gator hole wasn't made and wasn't retaining the water, they'd either have to find water somewhere else or perish, basically.
What are some of the other critters that take refuge in those areas?
Frogs and maybe small fish, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a note in the alligator management plan about colonial nesting birds and how some of these birds will deliberately take up residence in ponds where there are alligators. And I observed this recently myself in my own neighborhood. There is a large pond and we see herons, we see egrets. And the other day I saw a very large colonial nesting bird. I think it was a heron, but not 100% sure. And just a few feet away was an alligator. And I thought, well, they're pretty comfortable with each other. why is that?
So I like to joke and say that alligators make great baby bird bodyguards. Scientists have done studies to show, basically by putting these great big rubber alligators out at sites that hadn't had these colonial nesting birds documented to have nested there before. And they were able to basically show that these birds were selecting places that have alligators. And the reason for that is, you know, alligators can't climb trees. But there are other things that can that are, you know, not going to come around if the alligator's there, like raccoons and possums and things that would climb the trees and raid the nest and eat the eggs and hatchlings. And so the birds are basically choosing places where the alligator, they can benefit from the alligator's protection.
You're listening to Coastline. That is fascinating. It's an exploration of the wild animal population that shares the Cape Fear region with humans. My guest today, Alicia Davis, she's an alligator biologist with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, and Fallon Owens is the extension wildlife biologist with the WRC. Fallon Owens, we've talked about the fact that there are almost 40 different species of snake in the state. Only 6 of them are venomous. Why do we want to keep the venomous ones? What is the benefit of these guys?
Let's see. The quickest and easiest answer that I think would be easy to understand is free pest control.
And by pest control, what are we talking about?
Well, you know, the venomous species that we have are primarily going to be eating things like mice, which can carry diseases like Lyme disease with the ticks that they carry. Rats and moles, voles that can do lawn damage. You know, those smaller rodents are what are a lot of our larger snake species, both venomous and non-venomous, are really focusing on as a food source. So snakes are a vital part of the food web that keeps rodent populations in check. And they're also food for larger animals. So they are, you know, part of the ecosystem. And without those snakes, including the venomous ones, our ecosystems don't function as well.
Do all the snakes eat roughly the same kinds of things? Or are there some snakes that like rats more than mice?
Yeah. Not all snakes eat the same thing. A lot of our smaller snake species, like worm snakes that you would find in your garden or Decay's brown snakes, they like things like slugs and snails, which are also garden pests. And they're pretty much completely harmless. Like even if they were to bite you, it doesn't hurt. And then we have our classic black rat snake, which does kind of focus on rats and rodents, but they also are nest predators, so they'll go after birds' nests. They're excellent tree climbers. And then we have some like water snakes that are aquatic snakes that are also non-venomous, and they eat things like frogs and salamanders and things like that. So we have a lot of different species of snakes, and they focus on different food sources for sure.
So what about the water moccasin? A water moccasin can be deadly to a human. Is that right?
Yeah. And, you know, I got to say, I really hate the term water moccasin because it's used as an umbrella term to describe any snake found in the water. When in reality, we have several species of non-venomous water snakes, like our northern water snake, banded water snake, red-bellied water snake, all sorts of water snakes that are very aquatic, and they're commonly mistaken for the venomous aquatic snake, which is our cottonmouth. We only have one venomous aquatic snake. And cottonmouths, everything gets mistaken for a cottonmouth. And for better or for worse, cottonmouths really are pretty docile. They do have toxic venom, and you would not want to get bitten by one, but they almost never bite. You really have to be trying to kill one in order for a cottonmouth to bite. They do this threat display where they open their mouth and they show this white cottony inside of their mouth, and they will do that for as long as they possibly can to get you to leave them alone before they'll strike. But we have a lot of those water snakes that are mistaken for cottonmouths.
Yeah. So there's only one venomous water snake in North Carolina, and that's the cottonmouth. So we often hear armchair snake identifying experts say things like, look for the triangular head, and that's how you know whether it's a venomous snake or not. Is that accurate, and is that a reliable way to determine whether a snake is venomous?
Oh, not at all. So there are quite a few species of non-venomous snakes that will flatten their heads. They actually kind of squeeze their skulls and their jaws to make them flatten to appear triangular as a self-defense mechanism to make themselves look like they're venomous snakes so that they won't be bothered any further. But that is a recipe for these poor non-venomous snakes to get mistaken for venomous ones. And we have venomous snakes that do not have triangular heads, like our coral snake. So, you know, those rules of thumb on how to tell if a snake is venomous kind of across the board are very problematic and usually have a lot of faults in them. The best way to identify a venomous snake is to learn what our venomous species look like. Be confident in your ID capabilities. And then if you see that snake, you'll know it's venomous because you know what it is.
Right, right. What about coyotes? We've heard, I mean, several years ago, we heard that they're urbanizing and people are starting to see them in areas that are far more urban than they used to be visible. What's happening there and how dangerous are coyotes to humans and domestic animals?
Well, coyotes are very adaptable animals and they are exceedingly good at surviving really anywhere. And that very much includes our cities, our suburbs, even downtown areas of big cities across the country, like Chicago, New York City. Here in North Carolina, we've got plenty of coyotes that live in Charlotte and in Raleigh. Coyotes are ubiquitous. They are everywhere. And fortunately, they are mostly interested in eating things that are about rabbit-sized or smaller. They are omnivores, so they're very happy to eat fruits, and they'll even eat birdseed, rats and mice. And so to humans, they don't really see us as a food source. They don't want to attack us, or they really just want to be left alone by us, which is a common thread in this conversation. But when it comes to threats between people and coyotes, my biggest worry would be for outside cats and for very small breed dogs, because they do fall in that sort of roughly rabbit-sized category, and that's what a coyote could see as a food source.
And I don't think we've answered this question quickly. I think we have a minute or so left, Alicia Davis. If someone is worried about an alligator in their local pond or their backyard pond, what should they do?
Well, first and foremost, give it plenty of space. As a general rule, I say one school bus length for small alligators, two buses for large alligators, not just for safety, but also for respect for the wildlife. But number one, of course, don't feed them, whether it is on purpose or inadvertently. In some ways that people inadvertently feed alligators is by feeding the turtles or the fish or the waterfowl in the area. All the stuff that you're going to feed them is not good for those species anyways. So I strongly discourage feeding any wildlife in places where alligators are. And if you're a fisherman, take your fish scraps home. Don't drop those into the water by the boat dock.
So you are inadvertently feeding the alligators.
Yes.
If you're leaving your fish scraps.
Yes, especially if it gets nice and stinky because they love that.
Yeah. And at what point is an alligator dangerous? I mean, if people have been feeding them, how can you tell that the alligator is now a threat to humans?
Our biologists come out and do a site visit, and generally what they're looking for is they're looking for unnatural behavior. Primarily, if an alligator's been fed to the point that it's dangerous, it's going to start approaching people, that sort of thing. But it's pretty rare.
And there is a wildlife helpline to call, which we will put on our website. If either of you know it off the top of your head, nobody's going to remember it. We'll put it on our website.
Okay.
That is this edition of Coastline. I'm so sorry that we're out of time. Alicia Davis, Fallon Owens, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Andrew Craig engineered this episode, and we bid him a fond and a mournful farewell as he embarks on the next chapter of his life. We will miss him terribly. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or find it on Spotify, Stitcher, or Apple Podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.